You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is episode 17. And it's a whopper. You know, the assignments that students do in STS modules today are nothing like what they used to be. These days, they build portfolios with all sorts of things. Short writing, long writing, posters, blogs, in-class presentations. Add to these projects like podcasts, film clips, campaign strategies, briefing papers, debates, book proposals, and more. Today's episode brings you a sampler of student-made podcasts. These were created by Year 3 undergraduates in our Science Journalism module run by Dr. Jean-Baptiste Guyon. The assignment was straightforward. Create a 3-minute news feature about a recent piece of research at UCL. The piece must be usable as a news segment for radio or podcast. The piece must include a short interview, too. Students start with a recent press release from UCL, and they go from there. They have a tight deadline, and they have to work pretty much with the tools they have through a laptop and a phone. This is real-world work as a freelance journalist. For the podcast today, I brought together 8 of the ones I like a lot. They're varied, and they deliver the assignment in quite different ways. Details for each of the stories are found in the show notes. We'll take a break halfway through, but I'm just going to sit back and listen to these again. That means I'll see you on the other side.
We've been studying the heart for hundreds of years, and still we know so little, but this is about to change. Limits of imaging techniques and the practical challenges of imaging a moving organ have been obstacles in our understanding of heart structure and function. However, with the new X-ray technology HIP-CT, these obstacles are being overcome to see the heart with better clarity than ever before. HIP-CT allows us to see the heart at multiple scales, essentially creating a Google map. For example, a city is an organ like the heart, and at large scale, you see roads connecting the cities. Zooming in, you see regional traffic flows, the areas of function and dysfunction. Then at street level or the cell level, HIP-CT reveals how local structural issues, much like traffic and road accidents, cause more regional problems affecting the whole city, therefore showing sources of weakness in the heart. The research groups of Professor Andrew Cook and Professor Peter Lee are now using this technology to image the evolution of heart disease in blue baby syndrome and in children missing a heart chamber. Today, I speak with Professor Andrew Cook about this work and its clinical potential.
Yes, I'm Andrew Cook, and I'm Professor of Research and Education in Developmental, Interventional and Surgical Cardiac Anatomy at the Institute of Cardiovascular Science.
How is your research in heart disease using this technology?
So we want to look at to see how heart disease develops in the womb, how it progresses through childhood and then, of course, into adulthood, as well as understanding the basic origins of how the heart muscle cells form initially and how they grow in sort of early stages in life. Yeah.
And what's the ultimate aim for this work on heart disease?
I mean, the ultimate aim is to sort of picture that picture together to see how it evolves. It evolves after surgery. And then, of course, how we might be able to change surgery or even intervention later on in life. So that's with devices, valves that have been developed to be deployed in the heart without opening the patient up. So we might change the design of those based on the information that we're finding. So that's effectively what we're aiming to do. Yeah.
This is all sounding quite revolutionary for research, but what about its clinical potential?
With the techniques that we develop in the research arena, we can use this for speeding up or improving images that you see in the clinical setting.
So initially, HIP-CT would be used to improve existing images, but what are the next steps in achieving hospital usage of a HIP-CT scanner?
Yeah, I suppose the next steps really are to develop the technique further, to improve that technology to speed up the scanning time, which effectively will reduce the radiation dose. To put this in a clinical environment, in the end, you've got to have a limited X-ray dose. Now, of course, this technique is not inexpensive. And so the more you can speed up the scanning, then the more research you can get through, and the more research you can cover, and the more answers can be, more questions can be answered.
Evidently, research still has a way to go before we could be seeing the benefit of HIP-CT in hospitals and in diagnoses, but its revolutionary capabilities for heart imaging and mapping evolution of disease rouse great promise for improvement of medical interventions for heart disease patients in future.
Welcome to Simply Science. Today we have Dr. Sunny Wong, a clinician scientist, with us, talking to us about the microbiome and COVID-19. Hello, Dr. Wong. A while ago, you published a paper on COVID-19 and the digestive system. The paper highlighted how certain microbiomes and probiotics can be helpful in alleviating COVID symptoms, especially in terms of long COVID. Can you tell us more about what have you been working on in that research?
COVID-19 is an infection, it's a viral infection. And there are studies that look at the microbiota, and there are some changes. And so microbiome changes have been described for patients with COVID compared to healthy individuals. And also subsequent to this work, there were some analysis looking at the clinical data that the microbiome or some specific members of the microbiome, they were associated with some of the severity and also some of the post-COVID, long COVID symptoms. So after COVID infections, their symptoms and also their severity associated with some of these strain of different bacteria. And as a result, there were some studies looking at replenishing, for example, some of the beneficial microbes in this patient and trying to help their symptoms. And some even actually that correlate some of these microbes with the vaccine response as well.
Speaking of probiotics, there are a lot of products on the market that says probiotics work. Can you tell us how it would work, if at all?
And so I think there's a lot of development in terms of probiotics. So there are some data supporting that it might work because they are depleted. Several probiotics are depleted in this individual. So and there are some early data saying, for example, if we replenish these microbes, then might be able to improve some of the symptoms. So I think theoretically it makes sense, and that's a biological basis. I think we need more data in terms of the clinical efficacy. I don't think we have got to a stage of that we have proof that it works. So we still need more clinical data. But I think this is a very tantalizing opportunity, and it does make sense biologically.
Thank you for that. Can you share with us what you're researching right now?
The other aspect I would think is that we are looking at the interactions of diet, nutrition, on the microbiome, and also inflammation with it. So we modify the diet, what's the effect on the microbiome, and how can we make a better nutrition to improve our microbiome and therefore metabolic and digestive health. So this is something that we are working on and is interested.
Interesting. Thank you, Dr. Wong, for your time, and all the best in your research.
The WHO recently condemned formula milk companies for using, quote, unacceptably pervasive, misleading, and aggressive marketing strategies that undermine breastfeeding. They reported that more than 8 in 10 women in the UK are exposed to ads that increase their likelihood of using formula milk over continued breastfeeding. This is the Human Scientist Podcast, and you're listening to Monday News Bites with Nadia Rauch.
As part of protecting breastfeeding, ideally, the claims should be, and advertising should be, restricted. Breast milk's got all sorts of things in it. It's got stem cells, growth factors. Really, you could never hope to emulate in a formula.
That's Dr. Mary Futrell,
Professor of Paediatric Nutrition at UCL, Great Ormond Street Institute of Child Health.
Dr. Futrell and her colleagues recently published a study that looked at the academic performance of pupils who were given formula milk as infants. These formulas were enriched with different nutrients, including iron and long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids.
Abbreviated to usually as LC-PUFAs.
Which occur naturally in breast milk.
And it has been hypothesized that they may be one of the things in breast milk that helps to promote brain development and improve later IQ. This has never been really established, but they were put into infant formulas for that reason.
But in their study, by looking at children's GCSE test scores, they found
no effect of the LC-PUFA formula compared to a control.
In other words, students who were fed LC-PUFA-enriched formulas as infants did no better in maths or English at age 16 than other students. So what does this mean for the kind of claims formula companies can make in their ads?
So, I mean, certainly our data would suggest that for long-term cognitive outcome, you couldn't make a claim, at least for the types of LC-PUFA that we tested.
In fact, under the International Code of Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes, companies are technically not allowed to make explicit health claims at all. But the problem is that...
I mean, manufacturers do sometimes they can't make claims, but you can make statements of fact about things. For example, iron would be a classic one where you can't say that iron would improve brain outcomes, but you can say things like,
our SMA Pro follow-on milk is enriched with iron to help support their normal cognitive development.
Which could imply to some consumers that it's going to improve brain development. So it's not as black and white as you might like.
Which is why the WHO is calling on governments to implement stricter legislations on what companies can and can't say in their ads, since
you don't want any of these claims to undermine breastfeeding.
And just to be clear, formula milk is a safe alternative for children who cannot be breastfed, and no one should feel bad for using formula if that's what's best for you and your child. But it's important that parents are making informed decisions and know that formula isn't better than breast milk and won't make your children smarter. That's all for today, and thank you for listening to the Human Scientist Podcast. The information in this podcast is for educational purposes only and not a substitute for medical advice. To seek medical advice, please consult your GP.
Endometriosis is a chronic disease for which diagnosis can take up to 10 years. This is having detrimental effects on the lives of hundreds of millions of women across the world, but it may finally be changing. My name is Sophia. Welcome to Under 180. Just about a month ago, the European Society of Human Reproduction and Embryology released 200 pages of comprehensive new guidelines for the diagnosis of endometriosis. I spoke to co-author Dr. Ertan Saradoğan about what endometriosis is and the significance of these new guidelines.
Endometriosis is a condition where there is tissue similar to the lining of the uterus being present outside the uterus. Most commonly in the pelvic area around the uterus, ovaries, and fallopian tubes, but it can be found anywhere in the body.
For a long time, laparoscopy, which is an invasive surgery where a camera is inserted through a small hole in the abdomen, has been used as a gold standard for diagnosis, but that is now changing. This will not only accommodate more patients, but it could also improve the time of diagnosis.
Some women will be reluctant to have a laparoscopy because it's a surgical procedure. And similarly, healthcare professionals caring for women may have a higher threshold of arranging a laparoscopy as opposed to arranging an ultrasound or MRI.
While much of the rest of the guidelines remain the same as in earlier versions, they now include information of more extreme cases, such as postmenopausal endometriosis. Dr. Saradoğan thinks and hopes that they can help bring clarity and agency to patients suffering from the condition. He also makes it clear that the dramatic numbers we hear about how long diagnosis takes are quite debatable, and that significant improvements are already being made.
Guidelines will be an addition. You know, guidelines obviously summarizes what is published, and then it gives the armamentarium to the politicians or women or campaigners in general to actually use the published data to ask for things to change.
Despite these positive improvements, many challenges remain.
Management of endometriosis will remain a challenge to us. will remain a challenge to the sufferers as well.
The interest is there, however. Around the world, researchers are working on or wanting to work on improving treatments and diagnosis of endometriosis. And Dr. Sayadawan also lifts the fact that he's seeing more young people being interested in the condition, which is changing the landscape for the better. So perhaps one day soon, the description of endometriosis does not have to be so dystopian. This has been Under 180. Tune in next week for more science under 180 seconds.
I'm going to interrupt here. Let's take a short break.
What do I like about STS is that STS is a super small department. In those larger departments, you are really hard to get a chance to bond with everybody in the department. But in STS, it almost felt like we had this privilege of getting extra much attention from all our professors and classmates and schoolmates.
Let's get back to our sampler. We're halfway through, four down and four to go. If you're tempted to give this type of work a try, look us up. Search online for UCL, STS, and modules. This particular module uses the code HPSC0107. That's all in the show notes. Off we go for the second half.
Welcome to 3-Minute Science News. Very recently, researchers from UCL Center for Advanced Biomedical Imaging published a paper regarding a new cancer treatment, minimally invasive image-guided ablation, or MINIMA for short. Using a magnetic thermal seed, MINIMA can heat to remove tumors effectively and precisely in Woden Spring. Today, I have invited the lead author of this paper, Rebecca Baker, to give us an insight into the potential of MINIMA. Hi Rebecca, and thank you so much for joining us. So the very first question is, how does MINIMA work?
Basically, MINIMA uses the magnetic fields that are generated by an MRI scanner to move a sort of small magnetic seed. We can do this remotely using the magnetic fields of the MRI scanner. At the same time, we can use the MRI scanner to image the brain and image where the seed is, which means that we can see where it is at all times and can move it along a path that we've sort of pre-planned. By doing this, it can make the sort of movement very precise.
I see. It is the combination of imaging, navigation, and elimination makes MINIMA so effective and precise. So which type of cancer could MINIMA treat most effectively?
Ideas that we had in terms of where it would be effective would be the brain tumors. Obviously, brain tissue is very sensitive and delicate and important for our function. And so if we can treat the cancer without having to perform open surgery, then hopefully we can preserve function whilst at the same time killing the cancer. Some other cancers that we thought about are maybe the prostate. And so we're hoping that instead of, for example, removing the entire prostate, we can treat with this. And it would still be effective, and at the same time, there wouldn't be as many side effects for the patient. Other sort of diseases, especially neurological diseases, where ablation therapies are used include, for example, epilepsy.
What could be the potential limitations?
So one thing I would say is that when we started the project, we had the idea that MRI scanners are available in many hospitals. We could implement it very easily and make it very accessible. But in our research, what we've found so far is actually the MRI scanners would probably need some modifications. So you'd be able to sort of add on to an existing scanner. But basically, it's to do with the strength of the magnetic fields in the MRI scanner.
I see. An upgrade to clinical MRI is the key to start the next stage. Thank you for bringing us such an insightful talk. Though MINIMA is still at the preclinical stage, hopefully, after several years of research and clinical trials, it will be ready to fight cancer with minimal side effects and quick recovery. Thank you for listening, and see you next week.
to another episode of Student Speak, where we discuss issues pertinent to student life. I'm Jeweria, a finalist at UCL, and this week's episode explores the effects many of us face during the pandemic. The National Student Survey found that 27.5% of students mentioned COVID as a negative part of their student experience. Today, we speak to Dr. Wolg, who will give us an insight into his study of the consequences of the pandemic on students.
My name is Dr. Mark Wolg. I'm based in the Division of Medicine at UCL.
What exactly did Dr. Wolg's research entail?
So I initiated a research project to look at what exactly was happening with our students, people's home settings, the financial, you know, health, what can impact on their learning. And all of these were changed by COVID-19.
We all know the pandemic had an effect on students' learning, but why bother researching this? What would the outcomes look like?
There was very little information about how university students were being affected. For example, we didn't know if every student had access to the internet. And also students had been dispersed all over the world and the situation in different countries was very different. So we needed to get some information about how our students were coping so that we could maybe realign our learning or assessment objectives to make them more realistic given the changed circumstances.
Unfortunately, the medical impacts of COVID weren't the only factor affecting people's mental health. Many students were also distressed by cases of racism and discrimination.
And the news was dominated by racial disharmony and injustice in America, including the shooting death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. On top of that, there was a lot of anecdotal evidence that some foreign students, particularly overseas students, were being subjected to different forms of racial abuse.
Though higher education institutions made efforts to accommodate for students, they failed to acknowledge all the different factors that contributed to a student's unique experience.
And not all students were having the same experience. Our survey indicated that a fair level of resilience. We always think of students at university sometimes too much as being independent, if you like, agents. But in terms of many of them at home, they had maybe vulnerable relatives, etc. That was causing them a lot of distress and worry.
One may question, how trustworthy was this research?
Majority studies were conducted fairly well. They were fairly rigorous. I think it's trustworthy in terms, most of it, methodologically it seems sound, statistically it seems sound.
When considering what action to take going forward, what must we consider?
Talking about a student experience is really a heterogeneous type of experience, and it would be good taking that into account with policy, I think.
In summary, this study will allow students to understand their own experience as part of a wider issue and facilitate the development of strategies that will better the student experience. A massive thank you to Dr. Wolg for providing us with this incredible insight into this area of research. And thank you all for listening. Welcome to Diseases on the Rise, your weekly podcast created to highlight, inform, and help you avoid illnesses becoming more prevalent all over the world. This week, we're going to talk about non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, otherwise known as NAFLD. NAFLD is fast becoming the leading cause of liver transplants and is thought to affect 1 in 3 adults in the UK. Liver disease is the third leading cause of death in the UK, but what can we do to prevent it? To shed some light on this crucial question, we spoke to expert Dr. Torin Pullman.
My name is Torin Pullman, and I'm a teaching fellow at University College London. Previously, I worked at University of Oxford.
So what exactly is NAFLD?
NAFLD is a pre-clinical disease characterised by having what basically is a fatty liver, so something called hepatic steatosis. So the regulation of lipid is disrupted and you end up with lipid droplets in your liver.
And what does NAFLD progress to?
So it can progress to a number of fibrotic diseases. There's one called NASH, which stands for non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, which is a kind of pro-inflammatory fibrotic condition that can eventually then lead on to hepatic cancer.
What is thought to be the cause of NAFLD?
Well, we've been through what's technically been termed a kind of obesity epidemic. Basically, we've all gotten a lot heavier over the last 20 odd years. And that seems to have been caused by sugar. It's not necessarily eating lots of kind of particularly fatty stuff. It's been the kind of hidden sugars and the brines in processed foods seems to be a part of the problem.
Can NAFLD be reversed? And what would you suggest to avoid developing this condition?
Yeah, you can improve liver conditions to a degree. Once you get fibrosis, that's not reversible. And tumours of the liver are also extremely hard to treat. Your liver is incredibly adaptable. If you have a fatty liver condition, I'm pretty sure with lifestyle changes and diet, you would be able to reverse that. A lot of these conditions are becoming increasingly more common. So it's more about trying to understanding what those risk factors are a bit earlier on in life, you know, as in not tons of processed foods, not too much alcohol. Yeah, so reversible, yes, to a degree. And once it goes to a point, then I think there's nothing you can do. Liver fibrosis is extremely bad. And once that's set in, that's it.
So there you have it. Thank you, Torin. And thank you for tuning in to Diseases on the Rise. Catch you again next week for more episodes.
The average time for an endometriosis diagnosis is about 10 years for women. And in all that time, they're speaking to clinicians, trying to describe what they're feeling, and it's not landing, it's not being recognized.
That was the voice of Sophia Demian, an associate professor in applied linguistics at UCL. You might ask why I'm talking with a linguist, not a doctor, about endometriosis, but applied linguists like Professor Demian are working to include the experience of people with chronic conditions in research.
There is good linguistic analyses documenting pain descriptions in endometriosis. So women who have endometriosis, how they describe their pain. And there are specific patterns that can alert clinicians to the fact that this might be endometriosis as opposed to your regular period pains, which is often what the symptoms tend to get dismissed at. That's one way in which it can help people with chronic conditions, that it can take their experience as a source of evidence, therefore validating it and trying to create an evidence base on the basis of what they're saying.
We discussed how subtle grammatical choices that patients make when discussing their condition help researchers to differentiate between individual and shared experiences.
When I'm relating my illness experience and I sort of continue talking about me and myself and I using the first person pronouns, and then at some point I switch to using a kind of generic you. With that, I'm trying to communicate that actually this is my experience, but probably not just mine. It's something that's common to other people as well. This is generalizable and therefore it is more important. So these subtle shifts in how we communicate things carry additional meanings. So that's why linguistic analysis can add more to understanding of even just people's symptoms.
But linguistic analysis includes far more than that.
When you do linguistic analysis, you're focusing on the holistic experience, everything that people volunteer when they describe what they're feeling, as opposed to looking for specific mentions of specific symptoms. It allows us to look at the more social, more interconnected aspects of the illness experience, which have implications for why people do or do not seek medical advice, why they might be hesitant to take on medical advice, why they may or may not comply with some regimen or treatment that's being prescribed to them.
So there we have it. I talked to a linguist because by taking a broader view of what people say, linguistic analysis can help doctors help patients better. Existing insights and ongoing research will hopefully mean that patients, including those with endometriosis, get a diagnosis sooner.
You know, I listen to these and I think, well done, everybody. What a joy to hear. I also secretly think, wow, these are a lot better than I could do under the circumstances. Just so you know, there's more work to sample too, and we'll get to those down the line. Thanks to the students for their work, and special thanks to those agreeing to the interviews. You know, it's easy to say no when a student knocks on your door, but far more often researchers at UCL, they welcome students in and they give up their time. This kind of project just couldn't be done without their assistance, so specially thank you. Music today included two pieces, Rollin' at Five by Kevin MacLeod and Silly Intro by Alexander Nakarada. Both are available online at filmmusic.io. You also heard former STS student Beatrice Hahn, who was talking about her degree. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you want to find out more about the show, listen to past episodes, or give us some feedback, visit us online. Here's the address, so write this down. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. That's it for today. Thanks for coming along. We'll have another episode ready soon. So until next time, everybody, don't forget that there's knowledge to be found just about everywhere, and that together, we are STS. Bye now. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.